You were involved in the Chu Hoy program for the people doing the transcription. Chu Hoy was a program that was designed to encourage defections from Viet Cong, NLF personnel.
From both the NVA
and the
Viet Cong. Mm-hmm.
And so you were the only province-wide person in charge. Oh, I wanted to ask you, who was your superior? You mentioned
Harry Wagner, but the guy that really ran the thing down the guy in Saigon was Ozzie Williams. Mm-hmm. I only worked for Wagner for a very short time, and then he pulled out. And we'll go on. But I ultimately became the two corps director of the Chu Hoy program. Mm-hmm. So I sort of took his job.
Okay. Well, how did that program work?
I'd say that quantitatively it was extremely successful. Qualitatively, it was much less successful from the standpoint of the kinds of people that we got into the program. Mm-hmm. The program was multifaceted. It was more than just trying to get them in. It was mm-hmm. what you did with them when you came in. There was a rehabilitation section to it, which wasn't anywhere near as good, obviously, as the other side did. But the Vietnamese ran that side of it. They tried to reorient them, if you will. But then the things that were interesting to me, there was job training, vocational training programs, which I set up, and job placement back into the Vietnamese community. And that sort of thing was very, very rewarding. I liked that part of it a lot. But it was a big administrative, bureaucratic kind of a thing with 12 or 13 provinces and a person that was responsible to me out at each of the provinces and keeping track and numbers and things like that. So over 10,000, maybe 20,000 a year in terms of actual defections. Mm-hmm. But they were mostly rice-carrying non-military people. They were not officers. We occasionally had an officer, and that was seen as a military intelligence coup, typically. Mm-hmm. And we just turn them over to the whoever, and they wouldn't be part of what we were doing. But the program was, I think at the point I left, that was two corps was where most of the numbers were. Mm-hmm. And it was seen as a success, or was said to be a success, but in the years since I've thought about it, I don't think it really truly was.
But that's kind of typical.
Yeah.
I mean, so many things could have been or should have been,
right.
And analytically were made to be this. I know Bill Colby, who I saw just before he died. Mm-hmm. And that was one of his. He was really happy about that program, and he talks about the numbers. And,
right.
And, but I think, I mean, it was the next question I was going to ask him, the question you just answered, which is, did you think that qualitatively was it valuable? But on the other hand, it was supposedly part of a much larger pacification
yeah.
effort.
There were, for instance, in I Corps, they had the Kit Carson Scouts mm-hmm. that were part. I'm sure you were. Mm-hmm.
Well, tell the tape though. These were Chu Hoy with the Marine Corps.
Yeah, these were Chu Hoy with the Marine Corps, and they'd been essentially turned, and they went back after their old comrades, and from what I understand, they were much more aggressive about what they did, and they were much more successful. They really did bring some intelligence firepower to the Marine Corps efforts up in I Corps. We didn't have the same kind of deal where I was, however. When we got somebody that might be a lieutenant or even a major, they just simply turn them over to the Koreans or to the American military, and we never knew what happened after that.
What did you think about that process? I mean, that when you really had an asset that you might develop or could be developed within a single intelligence structure, and it sent
they just gave them off.
Disappeared. Yeah.
Well, I knew that we were not equipped to really debrief them. We didn't have the kind of people in our staff to be able to do that. I don't think that there was really good communication. We never got an understanding of what contribution these guys would make. I mean, as everything was so hush-hush that, it would have been nice to have been in the loop. You know, we're bringing these guys in. We essentially process them and get them to the point where they can be turned over. to somebody that does have intelligence, but we, I think that was always nettlesome to me, that we were never really seen as being a partner in this thing. We were just somebody to sort of feed the raw material to the...
Where did they come from? Where was their entry point into your program?
All 13 provinces.
No, I meant, what did the Chihuahua do that placed them within your orbit?
They would have these leaflets, mm-hmm. and they would bring them in, and if they had one of these leaflets, in most cases they would be seen as Hoichan, mm-hmm. which are the and they would be accepted at the provincial level, the provincial Chuhoy Center.
Mm-hmm.
And
the leaflet would tell them to go to the Chuhoy Center.
Yeah. Uh-huh. Mm-hmm. Actually, leaflet would say to surrender,
mm-hmm.
and you would be taken to there. So,
okay.
they could actually surrender to the military, although that was risky because,
mm-hmm.
especially our military. I mean, one of my big jobs was to go out and try to sell our military. I'd go out to military installations and drop down in helicopters and say, "Look, guys, don't kill these guys. Accept them in and try to get whatever intelligence you can from them. These people are wanting to give up, but they're." The Americans were so ticked off so often that they didn't accept that explanation.
They didn't accept that explanation?
Yeah.
You found, well, let's just talk just about the Americans first.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's curious, but are you saying that the American soldiers wouldn't accept the surrender of VC and Papen?
Yeah, I'm saying that. Yeah, that isn't across the board generalized statement, but that on occasion that was true.
Mm-hmm. And what about the Koreans?
Koreans had their own way of dealing with Hoichan, and Mark, you probably have heard
this.
But
I
was once, I'll tell you one personal experience, that I went up to Fuyen to receive four high-level Hoichan that had were coming over from Pleiku, that had been, for some reason they're coming to Fuyen, that they'd been on the border or something like that, and the Koreans were choppering them over, and there were four of them. And they arrived, there was one. And I asked, where are the other three? They're not with us anymore. But this guy, he's talking.
That's a true story. And confirmed.
Yeah.
That is, I have several other people I've interviewed who said, gee, I shouldn't really be, not with IBS.
Yeah.
Who said, I really shouldn't be telling you this story. I love it when they say that.
Yeah.
And then tell the story about the Koreans going out over to the South China Sea and throwing people out. Of course, in the War Crimes Museum in Saigon, there's a picture of that, but it's phony. That is, no one ever, there were no Vietnamese, nor, you know, who could take a picture
right.
of someone being thrown out. And also, the picture is an obvious phony. The person being thrown out is like cut out and
oh,
then
I
pasted
see.
On another photograph and then re-photographed. You can see it, and it's amusing when you see it, but it's unfortunately true, at least for the Koreans, the idea of making people talk by killing their cohorts. And there was a Pavan major that was captured. That happened too, according to these other things. So I'm not surprised, and thank you for saying that, because
that,
it does.
There, this was
yeah,
a
does confirm. What it means, I have no idea. I mean, at this remove,
yeah.
what value it is, but it's something to think about.
Well, I was on the tarmac waiting for these four guys, and only one showed up. And the Koreans were, they were both, you know, they were enigmatic, because sometimes they were just charming people. And sometimes they just blow you off without even thinking about it. And this was one of those instances that one guy just said, there's only one, but he's talking. And so I was there for mostly ceremonial purposes anyway. I'm, as I told you earlier, I didn't debrief these guys
right.
in any way. So it still ticked me off, though.
Well, within your purview of USAID, I mean, you were talking about job retraining and placement and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
These are things that USAID would be doing anyway. I mean, those are normal USAID work. But you were operating under cords.
Yeah.
And so this was the essentially a militarized operation serving the war. I mean, this was the USAID in Vietnam was part of the war effort.
Oh, definitely. I you know, when you say militarized operation, it was so funny. I mean, you've probably run across guys. It was such a mix and match kind of a situation. It was not clear that it was military. I mean, it was certainly supporting the war effort. Everything we did, if you look back, was supported the war effort. But it was not militarized in any way. I would not say that my job is in any way militarized. I was actually in charge of a major. That's how amazing it was. I was a 25 or 26-year-old guy, and I had a PSYOPS company commander major reporting to me, and I do his evaluation. Mm-hmm. There, from different provinces, you'd have, or at different provinces, different military or civilians would be in different positions. Mm-hmm. And it was hard to tell who was who without a scorecard, believe me. And, it was just probably the strangest organization I've ever. I worked for a pretty strange one now, but that was, gosh, it's got to have been the most amazing organization ever created at Cords thing. Holy smokes.
Did you ever meet Bob Comer?
Comer?
Uh-huh.
No. My brother did. My brother the guys I met, I met Abrams. I briefed Abrams. Westmoreland once. But I never did meet Comer. Comer was obviously the wild card guy. When I was there, he had this reputation of a loose cannon, but I never did meet him. No.
Well, just for the fun of it, since you just happened to meet Westmoreland and you happened to meet Creighton Abrams, what did you think of them?
The meeting with Westmoreland was more of a passing thing. I had no impression other than he's just, you know, high-ranking general. I did get to know Abrams a little bit, and I was very impressed with Abrams as being a solid, down-to-earth kind of a guy. As a matter of fact, they tried to keep me from briefing him. I had a reputation in Vietnam of being kind of I hated corruption. I always have hated corruption. I always will hate corruption. Mm-hmm. And I went in there with a vengeance to get rid of the Chu Hoi chief there because it was a very corrupt operation. And
the Chu Hoi chief.
There was a chief. This is the Vietnamese counterpart.
Vietnamese counterpart.
Yeah. And I got
corrupt
that.
In the sense that he was.
He was stealing money. He was. The Hoi Chan were living in abominable situations. They were being treated like prisoners instead of defectors, and that had to do lots of different reasons.
Was he releasing them for money?
No. Okay. Not to the best of my knowledge. Mm-hmm. He just simply was not putting, he was siphoning off the money.
Resources.
Yeah.
Okay.
And so Abrams was coming up, and I wanted to brief him on what's the situation, what's the current situation with regard to the Chu Hoi program. And so it was sort of controversial. We were in the process of getting rid of that guy. And as I recall, we went in to do a dress rehearsal. And the guy I was working for is running the thing. And Chalmers Wood was his name. He was a good guy, actually. But, I got up and did my, started to do my piece. And, whoa, time out. No, 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 no. You can't say that. And so they very closely scripted what I could say. They being the AID, the Cords people that were doing this. This was a big briefing, and everybody had a section of it.
Okay.
And if I remember correctly, I set it up so that with open-ended questions, or so that everything that I would talk about would generate a question.
Okay.
And so that General Abrams took the bait and asked me questions. So I effectively said exactly what I wanted to say because of the Q&A that was done afterwards. He was a savvy guy. I've talked to my brother about this. How come, you say to yourself, these smart guys, these enormously intelligent people, still couldn't get the thing turned around. Why is that? I don't know. The system, I guess, or whatever. But of all the guys I met personally, I thought that this guy would have, been able to talk to Johnson personally or say, look, you got this wrong. You got to change direction here.
Was he deputy commander when you met him, or was he?
He'd taken over.
He'd taken over.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
And Well, you're right. I mean, he was, of all the people, but I think...
But he didn't.
Well, I think he also knew that the war had changed. And there, he had very little resources, and we were withdrawing.
Yeah.
And my read was that he, just for your information, he really did make an enormous effort to change the way the war was being fought.
Really?
He brought in the only people who had studied Vietnam from a truly strategic point of view, without any shackles. And he brought the leader of that team back to Vietnam, Don Marshall. And he asked Marshall to do a MACV strategic assessment. And the assessment said, we could win this war if we did everything right in about 10 years. And we weren't going to have 10 years. So...
How would they have, just as a matter of course, how would they have dealt with the current Vietnamese leadership and the future 10 years down the road, leadership, which is the
yes,
crux of the problem.
That is, and it, there was no, so there never was. There wasn't in 1965 when they did the original plan.
Yeah.
It was that actually because of Tet, I think Tu had introduced reforms in the rural development program, the Revolutionary Development Program,
mm-hmm.
which from what I hear was just like Chu Hoi. That is,
yeah,
yeah. It sent teams out here, but no one would talk to these 18-year-old soldiers. That wasn't, but anyway, that there were changes in the Constitution. The political system wasn't getting more honest, but there was more political movement, and that could be moved forward some more.
Mm-hmm.
They believed that they destroyed the Viet Cong infrastructure. I mean, that is, the report was that, to them, the perception was that BC was becoming less of a problem, and more areas were pacified than before. The Hamlet HESs were really going up. And
this is in 67, 68?
No, this is 69, 70.
Okay.
And Colby would boast that, you know, he could ride on a motorcycle through most parts of Vietnam and nothing would happen, although he went with a huge entourage. And
mm-hmm.
Anyway, and so there was a sense after 1970 that the real problem merely now was the aggression problem, and that could be managed. As long as the internal situation could be improved, aggression from the north could be controlled. Westmoreland, when he left, put in a plan for cutting off the Ho Chi Minh Trail, an invasion of Laos, essentially. And that was, again, rejected because it put U.S. forces in too close to jeopardy of fighting main pitch battles with Davin that might lead to a Chinese intervention. And the resources would have been impossible by 1970. No one was going to send 500,000 troops in.
Right.
And, of course, the argument, well, it wouldn't be 500,000. Oh, come on. And the war was winding down. And Bob Sorley, Lewis Sorley, has written a biography of Creighton Abrams. It's called Thunderbolt. And now he's doing a little more. He's doing pretty good work on Abrams. And I sent him a piece on my evaluation of this, and I'm waiting to get it back. But I just have a feeling that he knew what the political situation was. And the time really had run out on the war. But you don't walk away. You do the best you can.
Sure.
And he tried to do... I still don't know about Hamburger Hill. I've never really understood that, and a lot of people say he's responsible for it. But I'll tell you this anecdote, and it's okay, it's on the tape, it's fine.
Okay.
His combat photographer, I mean his photographer, staff photographer, was a friend of mine, and he was a combat photographer, and he was just miraculously pulled out of line to be Creighton Abrams' photographer. And he, of course, like everyone else who knew Abrams, deeply admired him.
Yeah.
And... he was riding in a plane with him to some ceremony which Lon Holmberg was going to photograph. And Abrams turned to him and he said, you know, Lon, you're a college kid. You're a smart guy. You know, why aren't you an officer? And he said, General, I couldn't be an officer in this war.
Hmm.
And Abrams said, I understand. And it's that I understand that I'm responsible.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, he really did understand how the best and the brightest in Vietnam could see that they didn't want to be part of this. That, I mean, they could be part of it, and they were part of it, and they were doing it.
Right.
But that it wasn't, there was no there,
right,
so to speak, which is the kind of thing that in chords, I mean, if you take the pieces apart, you kind of end up with what you're talking about. Even where it's effective, it's not being effective in the right way, and it's not linked.
Right, there was no link. In chords, there was this amalgam of different agencies contributing bodies, but there was no real linkage. It was like the failures in American business in the Matrix organization movement of several years ago. It just, there's too many delinkages that occurred, and yeah.
Did you ever read, Orrin Story?
No.
He had a book called Slow Burn. He ran a provincial interrogation center and tried to make his center a model for all of Vietnam. He was working directly for the CIA. And
where?
That's the whole point. I'm trying to remember the province, and it's slipped out of my mind. And he tried to set up this, model.
The PRU?
Not with PRU. In fact, that was the problem. He was afraid of all those. What he wanted to do was have CIA assets that would bring people in, bring Chu Hoi in, and bring anybody captured or interrogated, bring them to the interrogation center, and then treat them like kings and bring their families in and build, like, hotels for them.
Mm-hmm.
The CIA really hated that. But really treat them like, hey, you know, look, we don't want any word intelligence. We're not counterinsurgency. We want to know what's going on. We don't want to kill people. Now, of course, intelligence and the final analysis might.
Yeah.
But we don't want you to tell the kid you grew up in that village that he's a VC. We don't want that information. We want to know the structure of things. We want to know what their plans are. And after a while, after treating them really well and knowing that they weren't directly harming their unit or people they knew directly, they were supplying information that was very valuable.
Mm.
And he was starting to collect this stuff on file cards. So they get the name of every cadre commander in every district and everything else. And he was ready to link this up. And the CIA, I think it was Ted Shackler, came out and said, what the hell are you doing? You know, look at these centers. These are resorts, you know, whatever. You're using all these assets. And he said, yeah, but look what we've got. And they weren't interested. And when he left, at the end of the war, he was begging them to give him just the resources to microfilm all the data cards. Because he said, this is the future leadership of the Communist Party in Vietnam. We've got them all on cards. We know who everybody is,
right,
who their families are, everything like that. And they said, just shut up, pack up, and get out of here. And when Don Marshall asked me, he asked me, do you think we could have won the war? Because I asked him the same thing. When did you think we lost the war in Vietnam? And he said, when do you think it? And I said, well, or why did you think we were going to lose or something? And I gave him that story, that we wouldn't even give the assets to microfilm the records on the leadership of a country that we were at war with.
Yeah.
And I said, if you can't think that far ahead and plan with these provincial interrogation centers, well, of course, maybe we had no business being there at all, but if you're going to do it, you're going to do it this way. You're just killing people.
Sure.
Or you're wasting all these resources. And it was, as one IBSer said, he heard this spotter pilot just saying, that arc light came in and the landscape lit up at night like a closet full of light bulbs. You know, the IBSer sitting there going, but those were analysts. You've just eradicated the lives of maybe 1,000 people, along with perhaps a lot of bad guys, as you use that term. But is that the way you're going to win this war? And no one processed that through to the top. People like Lansdale, of course, did. That was, he said, better a knife than a gun, better a gun than a bomb, because you don't win those wars. I don't know if those things are even possible, but there are certainly things that are sensible and things that are not sensible.
But I just get back to Lansdale, that, you know, your point about the black nature of the guy, and I guess from what my brother tells me, my brother was a West Pointer and knows people that knew him and has studied it since and so forth, and he says that Lansdale's, just his general personality was offsetting to other military people. But then I ask him, I mean, I've been around those guys a lot, and I said, how the hell did he get to be, what is it, retired as a major general, or lieutenant general?
In the Air Force.
Yeah.
They tried to stop him.
But how did, they didn't, yeah, they didn't get him stopped.
Yeah, no, I don't know. Through that.
Yeah, it's just.
But the problem with his, one of his real problems was that he took on the assignment of assassinating Castro. And, you know, these are assignments he accepted. He didn't say, I'd like to assassinate Castro.
Right.
And he didn't say, I want to be the person to trick all the Catholics, you know, to get out of the country. But he had this wonderful, he wasn't cold, but he really seemed like an intellectual, you know, a thinker,
mm-hmm,
and a doer. And that scares us.
Is he still alive?
You know, he died, unfortunately, I think in 89 or something like that.
Mm.
And it's one of those things I kicked myself. Because
never got,
I thought
to
he was
him.
Dead. I didn't realize he was alive. And I would love to. A lot of people were close to him. And his biography was a friend of mine.
Huh.
And but you were assigned, eventually you became director of the Chuhoy for
Tukor. Mm-hmm.
So all of Tukor.
Right.
And you did that until when?
I did that until late, through the two Tets, and late 68, if I'm correct.
And late 68.
That's when I resigned. That's when I had sort of had it with the AID and resigned, and I went back to Laos for those few months.
And with Frank Manley.
With Frank Manley, right.
Let's, just as long as you mentioned Ted, I actually have a book coming out on the Ted Offensive.
Oh, do you?
It's out as we speak.
Great.
It is being delivered.
I'll look for it.
It's just an edited volume of the best scholarship on the war, but the introduction, it's in paperback, but the introduction is, which I wrote, was, I think, a pretty good analysis generally of the issues of the Ted Offensive.
Uh-huh.
And you can read it in 5 minutes. That's a good point.
There you go.
Yeah, and but the essays are interesting and good, mostly very well written. In a collection, there's always one or two.
What's the title?
Title's just, oh, come on, The Tet Offensive.
Hey.
There is actually no book with that title.
Wow.
There's a Tet, exclamation point, and there's an intelligence failure at Tet, and these kinds of things, but there's no
right.
book called The Tet Offensive. I have a monopoly on that title.
Mm-hmm.
Very happy.
Good.
And it's in paperback and it's by Prager.
Okay.
And
look for it.
Yeah, look for it. Do you have an email address?
Yeah.
Oh, great.
I do.
Oh, perfect. Do you have a card?
Yeah.
Oh,
but
wait.
I don't have the email address on the card.
Okay, we'll stay here. I'll just write it down.
Okay. Okay.
And but I can send you the introduction actually if you want over.
Yeah.
You know, electronic mail. But the you were in Vietnam during Tet. And, you know, I would be very remiss if I didn't ask you about your perception of Tet, what happened, that is, when Tet broke out, your own perception of what was going on in the months before Tet and then during Tet and after. Oh, a lot of questions there. Let's take it in pieces. When did you know the Tet Offensive had begun? What were you doing?
I was, When I ask myself that question, I can't even come up with a clear answer for myself. Mm-hmm. I was living with an ambassador. I was actually living with the two corps. You know, there were five ambassadorial level guys.
Mm-hmm.
The ambassador plus the four corps civilians.
Mm-hmm.
Bob Madison was the guy in two corps, and I lived with him.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a villa in Nha Trang, and we were up in our eating accommodations where we were up on the roof of the villa where we were served dinner every night. And this was a holiday kind of a deal, of course, and we were up there and had dinner alone, I believe, that night, and hell broke loose. And we both went to bed, I believe, thinking it was part of the New Year celebration. We could see I think I'd been there the year before, or he had, and we'd never seen as much ground fire, firecracker kind of things going. I mean, and we could see it way, we had a real clear vision of Nha Trang and the outskirts, and things were happening way out that we didn't normally see, or he hadn't seen and I hadn't seen. At previous times, but we went to bed, I'm sure, thinking that that nothing was wrong that night. And we were living in a secure villa with a gate and so forth, but on a street, not much of a setback. And I got up the next morning, and Madison had already left. And evidently he had gone down the ocean drive to the headquarters.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd left much earlier than he normally did. And I found out later that he'd gotten a call to go. And evidently his car just took him and with no problems. When I got up and got out, which was around 7:30 or so, if I remember correctly, I saw the gate was open, and the guards weren't there. The housekeeper was still there, and she didn't mention anything, but the gates were open. Strange. So I backed out, and there's some automatic weapons fire, but not like there's a battle going on. Mm-hmm. So there are two ways to get to the compound, and I just chose to go this other way, which is a little bit faster, but as long as you didn't run into traffic, but I thought I was early enough. So I have a Jeep, and I back out, and I go down the street, turn the corner, and my car gets raked with gunfire. Mm-hmm. And I just turn a corner, and I mean, I'd never been under fire before. I'd never been in the military. All I did was hit the gas and turn it around, thumpity, 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 thump kind of a thing, mm-hmm. and go back into the compound. I wasn't hit, and my two tires were out, and the side of the Jeep was had bullet holes through it. Mm-hmm. But I think what happened there is they were up about the third floor in a building, just as I turned the corner, and they raked me, but I didn't get out. I was able to get back into the compound, obviously a little bit shaken at that point, and I called the MACV headquarters, and they said, I told them what had happened, and they said, just hang on, and they told me that there had been an enormous military undertaking overnight, and that the Trong was essentially unsafe, and they'd try to get me, because they were bringing all people into the compound, and it took about 6 hours before they came and got me, I think, because I remember spending the night in the compound the next night, or that night, I should say, but it wasn't real quick that they came and got me, so something had happened, and they were able to secure, they little by little took back Neutron. Mm-hmm. And then we went down and we spent the next 2 or 3 days right in the compound, and it was the most, right out of Catch 22, I think, that they were so stupid decisions.
Such as?
Oh, I don't know, just somebody took somebody raked the street from the MACV headquarters and killed a street vendor or something like that, and it was as some really stupid military decisions were being made by guys that, because now these guys that hadn't seen any action, now he finally got into action. But during the daytime, that was, I'm sure you heard, they put the bodies out on the street and let them bloat. And then about 3 days later, they asked me to go up to Fuyen to help interrogate some people. They couldn't tell whether they were Hoichan or POWs. They weren't, and how they were to be treated and so forth. So I flew up there and spent the aftermath of Tet up in Fuyen. I remember, this is an interesting, I met a guy, I've got a picture of him. He's got the mask, the blindfold on, and he was not a potential Hoichan. He just was one, he's another guy they paraded out for some reason. They wanted me to talk to him too. And he told me a story that he'd left Vietnam, and this is when I understood that we'd lost the war. This guy had been married about 10 years before, spent one night with his wife, and jumped on a trail, and had never been back since. And he made me understand that we did not have the determination to win the war. We didn't have the personal or national resolve. I finally understood it then. It was a click point for me, at least, uh-huh. talking to that one guy. But I did get to other provinces, and boy, they left those bodies out for a long time, to show the people that this is what would happen, and they, it wasn't clear to me that we'd lost anything right then. I mean, I read the Time and Newsweek and stuff, and they made a big, I thought that was liberal press kind of stuff, and that they wanted to make something out of nothing, and hey, we killed all these guys, and, you know, okay, they went over the wall at the embassy for a
couple of hours,
but hey, life's tough, you know. So we beat them back, and we let our guard down, is what I sort of thought, and it's a good lesson. It didn't seem to me that it was the beginning of the end at that point. And even a year later, I don't think I was there. I never thought it was the beginning of the end. But I felt, because of that incident in Huyen, that we would not win the war. I guess that's the way I should say it. I didn't think we'd lose it, but I didn't think we'd win it. I thought it'd be a stalemate.
Okay, so Walter Cronkite wasn't wrong. When, you know, this is the big supposed media moment was when Walter Cronkite says, and more it looks like the war is not going to end with a victory of either side.
Yeah.
The stalemate will end in negotiations. And oddly enough,
it is
what was happening.
Right.
And it was happening, but as you just mentioned, it was happening within you. And so
it's
so much of our construct is, you know, let's blame the media, or if we'd only done this. Mm-hmm. And yet, like most human events, it's this messy thing.
Sure.
And it's really, it's wonderful. That's I wish I could get my, you know, if I get my students to that point, where they stop asking the wrong questions and start seeing life, you know, that's life, you know.
Right.
Like, I won't go into the personalities, but somebody working for an NGO in Vietnam had been in IVS with another IVSer. And we're saying that this NGO's program was not effective. It wasn't responsive to what the Vietnamese people really needed.
Mm-hmm.
And this other IVSer came out to fire him. You know? And yet all of them agree. You know, I mean, they're all wanting to do the same things.
Right.
Like, how can that happen? How on God's green earth? And yet it was part of the personalities involved. It was something that wasn't just this NGO.
Right.
And the NGO was trying to do the right thing. It wasn't. And all for very good reasons. They had their own political agenda, things like that.
Right.
It's not surprising when you look back. But boy, as you remember, in the 60s and 70s, there wasn't any room for this kind of talk.
No.
You know, the battle lines were drawn.
That's true.
And you've been to Berkeley and free speech.
Right.
So as I was.
And the thing about it was, to be honest, Mark, I mean, I saw IVSers as being a dichotomy, you know, across a spectrum, but essentially left and right. And there were very few on the right, and a whole bunch of them on the left, if you will.
Mm-hmm. That was actually my next question.
And I saw myself as being kind of a centrist, I guess, kind of an unusual, not one of the real right-wing guys, but certainly not amongst those brethren, friends, you know, peacenik kind of people. And I truly believe that the war, it was a war that was worthy of fighting and should be won.
Mm-hmm.
And even today, to some degree, I wonder about, I still feel that we made a mistake getting in, but once in, we certainly prosecuted the war incorrectly.
Mm-hmm.
I'm one of those people that do believe that if you're gonna, once you do it, you can't not commit everything to winning it.
Yes, but I think the interesting thing, though, is everyone agrees with that.
Yeah, I guess
it's
that's
just
right.
That the political context makes it hard to make that statement.
Right.
There's no space to make that statement and not have someone scream at you.
True.
On the other hand,
because of the first thing I said, I don't agree that we got it in the first place. That's the thing
Well, that's where you're clearing some space for yourself that way. But the idea is that one of the reasons we went in there, rightly or wrongly, on the basis of a misperception of the realities of Vietnam. So whether it was right or not to go in, the way we looked at Vietnam was based on misperceptions, and those misperceptions translated into the way we fought the war. So in fact, the only way America could do what they did in Vietnam was the way they did it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I try to explain to my students, that we all know the war could have been fought more effectively, but it was fought that way because of our nature and the way we perceive Southeast Asia. That was my feeling. So that there wasn't any alternative except for us to do it this way. For example, was Johnson right in fearing an intervention with China? And it turns out, yeah, he was. So would you want your president?
It's too much of a risk even if he was wrong.
For what, though? See, the issue is that Vietnam was too worthless to be worthwhile that risk. And that should have sent off an alarm bell, which said, if it's not worth it, then let's not do it.
Cost benefit.
Yes, but he couldn't be the first president to lose a war.
Yeah.
And because of that, you get these links that make it impossible to do the more effective thing.
Let me ask you this, it's something that I've always wanted to talk to a historian about. My belief always, because I'd come from Laos, and I had this experience in Thailand. And all, you know, I'm getting educated all the time. I'm a young guy that doesn't, pretty naive getting into the deal. And I'm thinking to myself, well, we're in the thing now, and I read about this domino theory, and I mean, it's a construct that you can at least visualize. Mm-hmm. So, but where it came apart for me then and still does is, even if you accept all the mistakes that were made and we did, and say we lose the thing, you know, little by little, and the dominoes do fall, it seemed to me the point where they would stop falling was going to be Thailand, because of the monarchy. I mean, I worked in northeast Thailand, or in the northeast provinces of Thailand, contiguous to them, and some of my work took me over there. And I always felt, in my own heart of hearts, that it would stop, that they would not be able to win Thailand, and for the right reason, because the people would support the government. That would be the place where it would stop, because the people would support the government, which is what was missing in Laos and Cambodia and in Vietnam. I don't know, has anybody ever expressed that perspective?
Well, I tried to once. It's a friend of mine in the CIA, and he said, oh, don't fool yourself. But that's as far as we got with that conversation.
But that that was in their interest to feel that way, because that, you know, that was their career.
Oh, yeah.
Northeast Thailand was
run by the CIA.
Exactly.
Yes. But the idea is that the thing that the Laos, Vietnam, the Republic of Vietnam, and the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, all those three countries were all French Indochina.
Right.
And they had a historical arc, and this is the way that historical arc was going to run, unless there was a massive, risky attempt to change the course of that history. So the relationship between the Pathet Lao and Vietnam, Ho Chi Minh's vision of a communist, the Indochina Communist Party, this was all for French Indochina. It grew out of the French colonial experience.
Right.
Communism survived in Vietnam because the French killed off most of the others. And in other words, you couldn't be a nationalist without being a communist and have any chance of real success against the French, which is one of the reasons why Ho became a communist, just one. And I think the problem is Ho would have cut a deal and been what Vietnam is right now with the French. He made that offer.
Mm-hmm.
No ownership of businesses, private enterprise, property rights for everybody. He was willing to concede any of that to get independence. And yet, when everyone turned away from him, there was no hope. He had to rely on China and the Soviet Union, which he tried to balance against each other, and he failed, and ended up China more and more influence. Then China said, hey, wait a minute. If you suck the Americans into a big war, you don't really expect us to carry all that weight.
Right.
And of course, he said yes. And China said, oh, damn. Because they'd have to. And so with the Tet Offensive, the Chinese were adamant that they didn't want any of the Vietnamese to do anything that would force get the Americans really angry and make them do something bad.
Right.
Because then they'd have to back it up. And so here we have the Chinese, who are the thing that we're afraid of, intervention, and yet they too are afraid of intervention.
Mm-hmm.
And so you know,
dynamic is
it's really interesting,
right.
You know, and yeah, they don't want to, but they will if they have to. And the crux in the debate now is simply, well, could we have done something short of that that still would have been a major U.S. military effort, like cutting the Ho Chi Minh Trail and all these other fanciful ideas and strategy? Mm-hmm. And the trick, though, is that there wasn't anything in Vietnam, per se, that could be sold as justifying that. Johnson knew that. And as William Dyker wrote this beautiful book called Sacred War, it's about the Vietnamese, the whole Vietnamese war, from the Vietnamese perspective,
mm-hmm.
and the North Vietnamese perspective. And he says the most interesting thing about the war is 8 presidents who ran the war in Indochina, not one of them believed that it was worth a major effort for the American people. And in the end, we didn't make one.
Yeah, we didn't make a major effort.
We didn't
make,
well,
I mean, there are a lot of people with, a lot of parents would say differently.
Exactly, and it totally altered the course of American history
in
many ways. But whether Thailand could have been that...
Well, it just seemed to me that the power of the monarchy there was underestimated. It always was to me, because I lived there, as I said, in that hotel experience I told you about.
Mm-hmm.
I lived there, and the these people were pretty close to the monarchy. These people in the hotel, I think that it would have never gone to you know, down to Malaysia, down to Indonesia, down to Australia. You know, the most extreme views of the domino theory. But that was after it was started. I mean, I'm not saying that. and I don't offer that argument or that question really to talk about the Dien Bien Phu and the French, and it's sort of after we're there, after the Gulf of Tonkin, after you look at the way things were, and you say, well, would this thing really go all the way? And my view is that it wouldn't. Yeah. Wouldn't have gone all the way.
Yeah, but the problem though is for example, the United States believed on intelligence provided by Britain and France, the Vietnamese couldn't rule themselves. Therefore, this had to be a Chinese operation. You get Norman Schwarzkopf saying, my battalion was surrounded by Chinese. He said it not only in his book where he wrote it, but he said it in an interview with Dan Radcliffe.
Which was surrounded by?
He was an Arvin battalion advisor.
Oh, his Arvin battalion.
And then later he went to the Bataillon's Peninsula where he took a unit that would fuse to fight, was all washed out, and he whipped them into shape and killed 40% of them in a sweep, which is classic. I mean, for Batangas, that was unusual. But the idea is that we had this vision where we didn't respect the individuality of these countries, their individual history.
Right.
And therefore, Thailand would fall just like all the others, and Burma would. And the sad thing is, in 65, George F. Kennan, who invented the whole thing, said, but fighting a war isn't containment. That is, you can slow down the spread of communism in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
But you had Walt Rostow, who has said this in my presence. Indochina is like a thumb pressed on the artery of our trade through the Straits of Malacca and past Singapore. And if the communists control that part of the world, they can dominate. And that was the kind of dominant mentality. That and the fact that Japan was supposed to need a market for its goods in Asia because China had gone communist. Japan would follow if it couldn't maintain its economy, because it's a post-Cold War. If your economy's weak, you'll become a communist country. Can you imagine that in Japan?
Yeah.
And so, but anyway, that's what they did. And so they felt that Japan needed this. So the war in Indochina was fought for Japanese markets to keep our trade open, and because we couldn't afford an expansion of communism. But we could, as it turned out. That's awful when that happens. But we could afford it, in a sense. But whether Thailand would have been the country we could have defended, I think everyone will always debate.
Yeah, it's debatable.
Yeah, but the insurgency in northern Thailand petered out. The insurgency in Indonesia was crushed by the Indonesians.
Right.
And because they weren't Vietnamese. You know, the Vietnamese had a different history with communism.
Absolutely.
Yeah, right. And from a historian's perspective, it's like my students say, you make it sound so simple. And I said, no, it's horrifyingly complex. But it washes out in some typical historical patterns, and that doesn't mean that is the way it was. But in interpreting it, it can be made to look this way.
Right.
You can think about it that way. You know, Ho Chi Minh wasn't going to be Tito.
No.
You know, but Ho Chi Minh wasn't necessarily what Lê Duẩn became. And it wasn't a Stalinist vision. He didn't have a Stalinist vision for him. He would be disgusted by his tomb. And this, you know, it would horrify him.
Yeah.
And that's what Bui Tin, was in. He took the surrender of Big Minh at the end, at the presidential palace. But he was just a editor of the Communist Party newspaper. He held the rank of colonel and was everywhere at the right time and lived.
Timing is everything.
Yeah, timing is everything. And he's defected from Vietnam. And he's in Paris and he's trying to get everything he can to embarrass the government. But he keeps Robert Dornan, that name probably means something to you. Dornan is always attacking him because he's saying, Bui Tin doesn't recognize, you know, that he still loves Ho Chi Minh. And they have to understand that communism is bad and, you know, and all this. And of course it is. We can all admit that. Yeah. Marxist-Leninism stinks.
Well, we certainly say that communism doesn't work.
Well, Marxist-Leninism doesn't work.
Yeah.
I don't know what communism is, but I know that Marxist-Leninism doesn't. But that doesn't mean that people struggling for development and independence won't grab that straw and use it, and it might.
It's one of many, and it's very, you know, it's utopian, and it's very intriguing to somebody on the ropes. Right?
Well, as Bob Dylan would say, when you have nothing.
Yeah,
you have nothing to lose. Yeah, and the question is, what is nothing? And what is your life worth? And those are things that revolutionary movements develop. And with Chu Hoi, you know that better than anybody. It either works or it doesn't work. And for some it does, for some it doesn't.
And it can be both, as I said, because quantitatively and qualitatively, you got two different answers.
I think it was Kennan said, it was George F. Kennan. No, it wasn't. It was Matthew Ridgway. He said, he didn't use the word best and the brightest, but he said the best educated people in the villages are communists. And he says, we can't go against that. We don't belong there. This is like 1956.
Mm-hmm.
He says, we don't need to get involved in a war where the building blocks of a nation are against them.
Right.
That's not where you want to start a nation building. They're building their own nation. They've made that decision. But of course, nobody's made that decision. It's all made by time, place. Like I ask my students, what religion are you? And they all talk about it as if they chose it.
Yeah.
You know, whereas they just can't, their parents were Episcopalian, they're Episcopalian.
Right.
Parents were Baptist, they're Baptist, but it's like the biggest thing in their life, but they didn't choose it, which is why the Buddha gets at that. And he asks you, who are you?
Mm-hmm.
And you're always defined by external things or internal things that other people chose for you. There's very little that's actually you, you know, that you've constructed
right.
on your own.
Right.
And yet you've invested everything in these things. You'll kill for it, you'll die for it, and you'll never ask why. And that's why we have everything in the world. And it gets down to doctrines of non-attachment, which we need to get onto.
Okay.
But you, after, you did, by the way, in the Trung, there were several IBSers there. Dennis Rostra had been to the big Buddhist pagoda, with the big statue of Buddha in
mm-hmm.
the Trung, and they stepped away from it just as the BC overran it. That was their organizing point. If they'd stayed a minute more, they would have been dead.
Wow.
And a family hid them out in town until the town was retaken. And it was really touching. But he told a horrendous story that at McPhee, around the headquarters, there were some American sentries. There was a girls' school next door,
mm-hmm.
and they would stand.
They knocked the crap out of that thing. Yeah. Excuse my French.
Yes. Well, the guards, the American soldiers standing guard there, used to drop trowel, so to speak, and dangle their appendages
mm.
at the girls. And you know, to an IBSer, that was like, oh boy. Although, by the way, Dennis stayed there until he stayed there until 74. He worked for a bank. After he left IBS, he just stayed on and married a Vietnamese woman.
I see.
But in other words, there were IBSers in the Trung.
Yeah, I didn't run across many. I looked up IBSers in one other province that was south of, I forget the name of the province now, but I was down there for a couple of weeks on a particular assignment, and I looked them up, and I never left calls and stuff like that. And I never did hook up with them. And it was something, you know, I was IVS, but I was at Laos.
Mm-hmm. Right, that's
so
right.
A big
Vietnam,
difference.
Was, yeah. Was the name Don Luce anathema within USAID by then?
No.
And he'd gone. I mean, by the time you got there, he left in 67. Well, he was still in Vietnam, actually, but he wasn't with IVS.
I think Don was, I think people respected him for his views. I know he was an agitator, had that reputation, but I don't think I can generalize about that. Maybe other people felt differently,
mm-hmm,
but
mm-hmm.
I felt the guy, you know, sort of eloquently spoke his mind and,
mm-hmm.
and had a point of view, and obviously had a different perspective than I had at the time. But our perspectives are probably a lot closer.
Yes,
than
that's
it,
right. It's
right.
Like Howard Lewin was saying, you know, I was a real hard ass and all that.
He was, yeah.
And he said, and now, well, I got the impression that he wouldn't hug Jane Fonda, but that he thinks.
Well, has he seen Jane lately?
Well, no,
maybe he would. Howard?
Yeah, we talked about Fred Brantley.
Uh-huh.
And Howard said that, you know, he thought that Fred had come as an idealist, and because of that his anger about the war in Laos came from the destruction of his own idealism.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if that's necessarily true. I mean, I've interviewed Fred. I don't know if that's necessarily true, but Howard thinks of it in those terms now. That is, it's not, he realizes it's not all black and white, that other people had real feelings too.
I think there's a lot of feeling that we were duped. I think that general feeling amongst or being a pawn and didn't see it at the time, so you feel naive and you feel. But
you also work for USAID, and the people who are supposed to be pulling the strings, the IVSers thought the people pulling the strings were USAID.
Yeah, but were they? Or were they higher than USAID?
Well,
and USAID was also a pawn.
Right.
That's what I think.
I think that's things also. I mean, when you realize the war was run from Thailand,
right.
then obviously it wasn't being run by USAID.
Exactly, yeah.
Well, there's a new book out, by the way, by Roger Warner. It's called Backfire, and it's about the history of the secret war in Laos. And there's about 20 pages on Fred, and but mostly it's about the CIA trying to wage this war in this without literally connection with the State Department or anyone else as much as possible,
mm-hmm.
and doing it so indirectly. And the result of that was there was no real control.
Do you have a sense of how overt that their operations were in Laos versus elsewhere in the, or their at least their identity, and in the communities and so forth, as opposed to, for instance, Eastern Europe or even Vietnam?
Well, I know that it was less overt than in Vietnam, because in Vietnam it was
less covert.
It was more open. Yeah. In Vietnam, I'd imagine, but they just gave things names, and there were projects like Phoenix. That, mm-hmm. You know, it's even a Vietnamese name, and it's Vietnamese who are supposed to be doing all the things. It's a coordinating program.
But in Laos,
if you ask me, I would say that it was overt enough that some USAID resigned, that they felt that they had a feeling that they were simply being manipulated, and they were doing the work, but they weren't masters of their own domain.
Mm-hmm.
And a couple of people, I can't remember who, actually left USAID because of that in Laos.
I might have a different perspective
on
that. I think that my sense was that, at least in Pak Se, which was the place that I lived, mm-hmm. that was a, I mean, those were just guys who lived in that house.
Right.
And everybody in town knew that those guys were those guys. Mm-hmm. And in Laos, in Vietnam, because of cords, and of course cords kind of feathered everything together, those guys had a separate house, but nobody knew exactly where it was, and it was I think it was more covert, and especially when you talk about the PRU stuff uh-huh. that was going on in outside of Neutrong or uh-huh. run from Neutrong,
uh-huh.
They kept that real. I happen to know about it because I had a good friend who was a Foreign Service officer who was on the CORDS team but was living with the CIA guys. And he never invited us over or anything like that. We never got to see the operation, the fellows that I was working with, but we heard a lot about it over beer at the officers club or something like that, and from this guy, and he was quite a liberal guy, and it was very very interesting dynamic having him live with those folks and them running the PRUs and his feelings about it. Interesting dynamic.
The PRU is when we first started this, I said be sure to ask IBSers in Vietnam whether they ever encountered PRU. Paul said, what? And you know, to me that was other than the bombing, just generally in the south and in Laos and Cambodia, the PRU teams were the ones that most kind of stick in my craw.
Yeah, me too.
Because
they're a killer. They're assassins.
Yeah, right, and it's.
And you know, everybody always asks me, "Are you? To what degree do you know that Americans participated in that?" And I can't say for sure one way or the other. My sense is, maybe I want to believe that our guys weren't really at the end of the triggers, and we just ran the Vietnamese, but I don't have a clue.
But it's also the lack of discipline and the fear that they inflicted on just regular Vietnamese. I mean,
yeah.
It's just, and the way that you would hang around, you know, in compounds. I mean, it was like an Inquisition team,
yeah.
or something.
Yeah.
And that, you know, it's tough. I was at a special operations school, and we were asked about Phoenix in general. I said an operation can be successful, but the patient can die. That there's some things that even if they're quote efficient, even if they can be made to be proven that
mm-hmm.
they were, that doesn't mean necessarily that overall it fits in the picture. And then a Phoenix operative, who is now a wonderful historian, said, well, sometimes there are people you have to kill. He's a 3-tour of duty in Vietnam, I can see his point of view.
Sure.
And then Harry Summers,
oh, yeah.
who is often the world's largest windbag, but as a human being, and a decent one in his heart, but often says the most just things that it would drive me crazy, and then I'll ask him personally about it. And of course, I'll express a completely different view.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, there's some things the American people don't want done in their name. And you know,
and I don't think that the American people wanted that done.
I don't think so. Whether it's necessary,
yeah.
or whether it's effective or not, actually doesn't matter if it's not something that can be sanctioned as. As someone said about atrocities, a former adjutant general, the U.S. Army, he said, that's how you lose wars. When you do things that are against the public will,
mm-hmm.
and keeping it secret sure. makes it worse, because the whole POW-MIA issue, you know, to me, is all rooted in that same sense of betrayal that anti-war leaders felt. But now it's applied to these families who, you know, they've realized that their government betrayed them. And I think you could tie that into El Paso, into Oklahoma City.
Mm-hmm.
That if you don't believe you can trust your government, you can end up like Montana. There are Zionists who want you to buy into anything because the old explanation is just rotted away. You can't trust your government. So they're, why? Well, to destroy the American government must be this great conspiracy. I mean, it can't
right.
just be incompetent, you know, because Americans are all efficient and good, and we don't make mistakes.
Yeah.
The point is that...
Well, you need to be around machine organizations to understand how incompetent
oh,
they can
absolutely.
Be. It's,
even with the best and the brightest.
Exactly.
In charge of... After 68, you left USAID. Why did that happen? Why did you...
I didn't believe in the war effort anymore. It didn't seem like the right thing to do to be involved in it. I still liked Asia. I loved Asia, always will. And that's why I went back to Laos. I also had a disagreement with regard. I'd been given a promotion to what they did temporary promotions back in those days, and they were supposed to be made permanent, and there was some paperwork that got messed up with me, and never my promotion never came through. My peers did.
Mm-hmm.
Ultimately, it turned out to be a paperwork thing, and when I was in Laos, I got a telegram saying, we apologize, and you were right, and it's all cleaned up, and come on, everything is, come on back. And I thought, at this point, I was back in Laos and working for Manley, and I said, I don't think so. The driving force was really my losing faith with the strategic objective of what we were doing in Vietnam. But I didn't want to leave Asia, so I wanted...
How would you define that strategic objective?
Well...
What precisely did you lose faith in? I mean, I don't mind.
The,
it's a repeat. It's
sure.
Okay, but...
I failed to see how what we were doing would achieve the end that we said we wanted to achieve. I wasn't saying that the war, I still hadn't come in my own mind to the point where the war was wrong,
mm-hmm.
but prosecuting the war the way we were prosecuting it was wrong. Putting the resources where they were being put, and in my particular world, not going more aggressively after what we were trying to do seemed wrong. I thought we ought to be doing a lot more.